So tonight I want to base my whole talk on something called the Sabha Sutta, which is of Majjhima Nikaya number 2. And the title is All the Taints. And so, first of all, the word taint, I want to talk a little bit with the word taint. I actually looked at I looked things like this up in the dictionary, because some of these, like, you don't hear that word a lot. It's not like a common word in our parlance anymore. But here's the definition, the dictionary definition: a taint, a trace of something bad, offensive, or harmful. But I don't think it's important that it says a trace. So it's not like a big glob. It's a trace. It's just there. It's not, can't deny that it's there. You know, sort of like you scuffed your shoe, and there's a your shoes are now tainted by that scuff, right? It's that sort of level. And I want to start actually by reading something from the Dhammapada. And this is how the Dhammapada begins. And I think it's quite interesting that it begins in this way. He's talking about the importance of dealing with these taints, I suppose. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering will follow you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness will follow you like a shadow that never leaves. He insult me, hit me, beat me, rob me. For those who brood on this, hostility isn't stilled. He insulted me, hit me, beat me, rob me. Those who don't brood on this, hostility is stilled. Hostilities aren't stilled through hostility, regardless. Hostilities are only stilled through non-hostility. This is an unending truth. Unlike those who do not realize that they were on the verge of perishing, those who their quarrels are stilled. I love this last part, the last verse. On those who don't realize that we're on the verge of perishing. Those who do, quarrels are stilled. On the verge of, and it's like, oh, this is just acknowledging the fact that we don't know. This could be like tomorrow. We're gone. We don't know that. It's not, we have no way of knowing when that's going to happen. Could be tomorrow, it could be 20 years from now, who knows? I mean, for some of you, 50 years from now, perhaps. But we all know that we're always on the verge. It's just like there's that little thin membrane that we pierce the membrane and psh, we're gone. So, that's more, I'm not trying to be morbid, I'm just trying to go, that's a way to think about things in terms of, oh, I have to, this practice is important because I may. This might be the last time I practice. Who knows? It's just like it's right there on the edge. I also want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is from his book Mindfulness. And this is a section he called What is skillful and what is not? By emphasizing the recognition and knowing of the unwholesome roots and the wholesome ones in their essence, the Buddha is highlighting the wise discernment of what is skillful and what is unskillful. That is, discerning what leads to happiness and liberation and what leads to suffering. Although this discernment is basic to the Buddha's teachings, in our Western culture, it is a very delicate process. For many people, it's an easy step from recognizing a particular mind state like greed or hatred as being unwholesome to the feeling that you're a bad person for having it, or that somehow it's wrong for the mind state to even arise. This pattern of reaction simply leads to more self-judgment, more aversion, and more suffering. It's not a helpful cycle. It's important to understand which mind states are skillful and which are unskillful, not in order to judge ourselves or be reactive to them, but in order to see which lead to happiness and should be cultivated in our lives, and which lead to suffering should be abandoned. The distinction between wholesome and unwholesome mind states brings a moral dimension into psychology. This is particularly important because the different states are not only arising in our minds, but they also what motivates our actions. So this is something about the Buddhist practice that we tend to forget if we're not careful. We tend to forget that there's a necessity to cultivate purity. I mean, this is the beginning of how the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's description on mindfulness, starts. Because this is the direct path for the purification of beings. First thing he says, right out front, by the way, this is about purification. So, but the trick is, and to point it out very clearly, is we can't let the fact that we're tainted, because we all are, it's more or less, we can't let that get in the way. We can't let that be, oh my God, I'm so tainted, what's wrong with me, I'm just so full of taint, you know, and weep and moan about it and all, you know, self-judgmental about it. This is just not helpful at all. It's so easy to go there, but it's not helpful when it gets in the way. All of this is, all we're doing is creating more of our own suffering. That's all we're doing. So, now let's go to the sutta itself. Oops, I lost my plate. Oh, here it is. This is the Buddha speaking. Bhikkhus, I say that destruction of taint is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. Who knows and sees what? Wise attention and unwise attention. When one attends unwisely, unarisen taints arise and arisen taints increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen taints do not arise and arisen taints are abandoned. So he's talking about being mindful. If you're really mindful, these taints don't catch you. You don't get caught by them. Bhikkhus, there are taints that should be abandoned by seeing. There are taints that should be abandoned by restraining. There are taints that should be abandoned by using. There are taints that should be abandoned by enduring. There are taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. There are taints that should be abandoned by removing. There are taints that should be abandoned by developing. So here's yet another list. This is the list. This is the seven ways that we can work with skillfully these taints. Okay. And basically, the first one of these is, you know, we abandon them by seeing them. Well, basically means, oh, we're actually mindful that a taint has arisen. Sure enough, there's one. And it's not like, remember, there's no judgment there. It's just like, oh, there's one. Being mindful is what allows to see this happen. And then the Buddha goes on. This is how we attend wisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? Oh, this is how he attends unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been that, what shall I become in the future? Or else he's inwardly perplexed about this present moment. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where's this being come from? Where will it go? So these are all questions that people ask themselves all the time, right? Like we look at our past and try and figure it out. We look into the future and try and figure it out. We just look in the present moment and go, well, what's going on right now? And he's saying these are, we don't see this. When he attends wisely in this way, one of six views arises in him. Oh, when he attends unwisely in this way, one of six views arises in him. The view self exists in me arises in him as true and established. Or the view no self exists in me arises in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive self with self arises in him as true and established. Or I view I perceive not self with self arises in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive self with not self arises. So he's just going through all these sort of permutations and combinations of how it's caught in selfing, essentially. This speculative view, because it's called the thicket of views. I think it's a great phrase, the thicket of views. The wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person is not freed from birth, aging, death, from sorrow, lamentation, and pain. And then, of course, he does the opposite. Bhikkhu is a well-taught noble disciple who has regard for the noble ones, who is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, who has regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. This is how we often, we start to see things, we start, I've got this all figured out, we have a view. That's why it's called, it's directly related to what's called right view and wrong view, or wholesome view and unwholesome view. And we keep seeing things incorrectly when we get caught in all these questions that were just, I listed a bit earlier. We get caught in trying to figure this stuff out. We think we're seeing things clearly, but we're not. This is a taint. This is something that stops us from being clear. And I find it interesting that it's like, oh, then he goes on. He attends wisely. This is suffering. He attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When he attends wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him. Personality view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. So what he's saying is we give up this endless, fruitless speculation, trying to, you know, answer the unanswerable questions. Who was I in the past? What was I in the past? Who am I going to be in the future? Will I ever be in the future? Who? What am I now? We can just drive ourselves pretty crazy pretty quickly. But that's all of those things are just ways that are taints. And they all create personality view. They all create a sense of, because we're all of these, there's an I, there's a self involved in all of these. So to let go of that by just paying attention to the Four Noble Truths, which is what I just listed. Personality view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances, which, you know, the Brahmanic culture that the Buddha lived in, which was just totally about rules and observances, everything. You know, you wanted to wash your clothes, that you had to pray the right way before you washed your clothes. And it was just endless, that had this traditional view of things. And he's saying, if you just stop selfing, if you see clearly that this selfing doesn't get you anywhere, then those taints are abandoned. So that's the first one. And then he talks about restraining, the second one. How do you get rid of taints? By restraining. And this is like consciously choosing what we take in through the senses. I mean, basically, if we just leave our sense doors wide open to anything that comes along all the time, we end up taking in a lot of stuff that isn't that good for us, let alone when we start to seek out certain kinds of sensory input, which is not good for us. And I'm not saying we shouldn't pay attention to the news, as stressful as it can be sometimes. I'm not saying that. But we have to, maybe I don't need to do so much of that. Maybe I need to sort of back off a little bit. I talked about this a lot last week, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it this week, but it's like the whole idea of restraint, it's sort of viewed in our culture as, well, that's not fun. Who wants to restrain themselves? But that's that's a way of removing the taints, by having some restraint and choosing not to get caught up in things that at some level we know, oh, this isn't too good for me. It's not purifying my mind, it's doing the opposite. Oh, okay, maybe I need to just step back. Okay, then the next of these is taints abandoned by using. And when I saw that, I went, oh, wait, how can you abandon something by using it? This is what the Buddha says. This is an interesting section. I want to read the whole section here. What taints, bhikkhus, should be abandoned by using? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of concealing. Reflecting wisely, he uses alms food neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort, and for assisting the holy life. Considering, thus I shall terminate old feelings without arising new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless, and shall live in comfort. Reflecting wisely, he uses the resting place only for protection from cold, for protection, same list. Reflecting wisely, he uses the medicinal requisites only for protection from arisen, afflicting feelings, and for the benefit of good health. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not use the requisites thus, there are no taints, vexations, or fever in one who uses them thus. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by using. So the thing about this list that he's just gone through is he's talking about the four requisites that monastics are allowed, right? They're allowed to have a robe. They're allowed to have, alms food. They're allowed to have a place where they rest, and they're allowed to have medicinal things when they need them. And and today that's still true of monastics in this tradition. So it's quite strict. But what he's basically getting at here is, no, you don't need three robes and a fancy one, and you don't need a big fancy place to live in, and all those things where the mind can go if they're not careful. It's just like, use these things. You can use them. You can have this stuff and use it, as long as you use it wisely, that you don't have more than you really need, that you use it just to take care of this body, because a lot of this has to do with taking care of the body, right? And this is important because without this body, we can't progress along the path. If this body's, weak and emaciated and sick, well, it's put to practice. So he's talking about, staying healthy by eating, but not getting caught in fancy food, by not having to have fancy clothes, by not having to have a fancy place to stay, by just using the medical stuff because you really need it. But nothing on that. And so, this is like, we actually do use these things, but we use them in this way that they don't cause the arising of taints. Well, that's great for monastics. What about householders? What about us? What is it for us to be restrained in this way? And there's actually, this is a book called What the Buddha Taught by Wapola Rahula, who went and studied in Thailand. I'm heard in Sri Lanka, I believe. And he talks about this very topic. And so he's quoting from a sutta, and I've yet to be able to find the actual sutta, to be honest with you. Once the Buddha told Anapanasatika, the great banker, one of his most devoted lay disciples, who founded for him the celebrated Jetavana Monastery, that a layman who leads an ordinary family life has four kinds of happiness. So first of all, he's saying, oh, layman's going to be happy. It's not like, oh, you're a layman, well, sorry, you're never going to make it. It's like the Buddha had many, many lay disciples. The first business is to enjoy economic security or sufficient wealth acquired by just and righteous means. So it's okay to have a job and make money. And as long as it's done by what he calls just and righteous means. There's a famous list of all the things you shouldn't do and things that are more proper for you to do. No need to go there. The second is spending that wealth liberally on himself, his family, his friends, and relatives, and on meritorious deeds. So not only is it okay to make a good living, it's okay to spend money. You don't have to be a miser. You should enjoy this stuff. But you should also spend it on meritorious deeds. In other words, on taking people who have less. You should do whatever you can to help others in the world. If you have more than you need to live well, you should spread it around. The third is to be free from debt. When I first saw this, I went, oh, wow. How counter our culture. I mean, think about this, how our culture is all about, at one level, about going into debt. How debt is the way that you achieve the good life. You go into debt to get through school, you go into debt. And I'm not, once again, I'm saying you should never be in debt. If you want to own a house in our culture, for instance, oh, forget it. Unless you happen to be extraordinarily wealthy to be with, you're going to have to go in debt for a while. But then what you need to do is do what you can to get out of debt as soon as you can. When I bought my house, my first house, not this house I'm living in now, but the house I lived in before up in Canada, I had a 20-year mortgage. And it seemed to me like, oh my God, 20 years, that's like forever, right? I paid it off in 11 years because I was determined to be out of debt. And admit that, money I would normally use to go on an exotic vacation place, instead, my mortgage had what's called a balloon payment. And every year I could put so much extra money into the mortgage. And I got out of debt. And I've been on it ever since. And it's such a freeing experience. The Buddha says this because it frees us. When we're in debt, we're sort of bound to the debt in a sense, because now we have to make enough money not only just to live, but we make money to pay down the debt. And it just wears us out. We start acting and doing things that we may not want to do because we go, oh, I got to pay debt. It's a very difficult thing to do, to be in debt and live that way. But our culture encourages us to do it all the time, to stay in debt. It's good to be in debt. This is so counter our culture. And the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, understood this, which is, I think, fascinating. He says, the fourth happiness is to live a faultless and pure life. Sila. This is, so it's okay as householders to use things. We have, if you have a job, you need tools. If you have a, I mean, even if it's like you're just sitting at the desk, you need a good computer, you need a printer, you need, all that, the modern tools of life in the modern world. If you're a Dharma teacher, you better have a computer these days, or you can't Zoom with people, right? So you have to have a monthly Zoom account and blah, 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 blah. Those are just tools. So as long as you see them as tools, as stuff that is useful because it leads towards being able to live in the world through righteous means, it's all okay. It's not like we need to all be monastics. Monasticism is a wonderful thing if that's your thing. I would make a terrible monastic myself, never considered it. But it's like, it's a difficult, extremely difficult life to lead because it's so restrictive. We talked about the four requisites. That's it. That's their vow. They say that's all you can ever have. You can't own anything except your bowl for your collecting dana, your clothes, a place where you sleep, but you don't own it. You just sleep there. In Buddhist time, they all slept in the forest in little huts anyway, right? And so it's like it's very strict. But so as householders, we just have to understand it's okay to function in the world. Just and use the things of the world, but just not to share what we have, and not and try and not get caught by it. By I need to have a new boat every year or a new car every year, and of course that which creates this perpetual debt cycle, right? That it's okay to drive a 15-year-old car that still works, if that's what you need. You need a car to get someplace. It doesn't have to be a fancy one. It's just something that works, right? That sort of thing. I don't want to beat on this any longer, but this is where he's going here. So then, so that's the third. So we have seeing, restraint, using. Then, this is everybody's going to be everybody's favorite, I know. Enduring. What typically should be abandoned by enduring? Here a bhikkhu, we think wisely, bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with gadgets, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing. While taints, cessation, and fever might arise in one who do not endure such things, there are no taints of vexation or fever in one who endures them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by enduring. Sometimes this is what we have to do. We just have to endure. This is, expression I use all the time, and it's maybe it's a cultural thing, is, the cards I got dealt. This is what I got. Okay. Sometimes I may not be happy with it. At times it doesn't work out the way I want it to, but I have to endure. I have to be able to go, that's okay. I be content with this, even if it's really unpleasant. And this is a hard thing to do. he's talking about, their life in the forest where they're trying to stay away from wind and sun and mosquitoes. But this is part of life. And so what we're talking about here is not trying to, don't put a lot of energy into trying to avoid the unavoidable. Some things you can't avoid, like getting old. There's one we can't avoid, right? It's like as the body ages, it changes and it gets slows down, and some things you used to be able to do, you can't do or can't do so well. To try and change that, to avoid it somehow, is just going to create a lot more suffering for you and for all those around you, for that matter. And here, this is the thing. You don't, sometimes we think, oh, I can't practice. I can't sit and meditate if I don't have perfect conditions. If it isn't just like, there's no bugs around. The people on door next door don't have their stereo on, and whatever it is that whatever your favorite pet peeve is, because we all have pet peeves about things. It's like it doesn't make any difference what the conditions are, as long as there you choose to pay attention. You can just like oh, there's you can note the a note how annoyed you are. That now you're being mindful of your annoyance about the music from the guy next door. That doesn't mean you're not meditating. It just means you're meditating on something that maybe isn't that pleasant, still meditating. You're still noting what's actually arising in the moment, even if what's arising is annoyance and pleasantness. It's just that we just note what's arising. We endure what's arising without trying to fix it somehow. Like, and this applies not only to practice, but I think to life in general. There's certain things in life that are just unavoidable, not just in our practice life, but in just our daily life. Where you live maybe isn't the perfect place. It's a bit, the neighborhood's noisy. I mean, we just had a lot of construction just literally down the block from us, going on for 5 days as they were repaving the road. And it was noisy. I thought they were working on my garden. It's like, oh God, it's so noisy. All those trucks and the big things and those diesel engines. And I could have got annoyed. I said, well, but look, Martin, I just look at the flowers and not let it get to me. I just endured it. And it was okay. It wasn't, and then it was done, and I have a nice new paved street just out, down the road from me. It's just a matter of attitude. I can endure this because it's just what is. Buddha goes on. So that's number four. Number five, taints to be abandoned by avoiding. What taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by avoiding? Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering unsuitable resorts, and associating with bad friends. Since if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of evil conduct. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not avoid these things, there are no taints, vexations, and fevers in one who avoids them. These are the taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. Well, we probably don't have to worry too much about wild elephants and wild bulls. And I think this is like, once again, the culture of 2,500 years ago, living in the forest. But there's also, there's all stuff in this world all around us that we know. Probably want to avoid that. I've lived in the city, big cities enough that I knew there were certain neighborhoods in those big cities I should just not go there. That'd be like going to the place where the wild elephants are. So why go? Why do that? And I'm not saying those were bad people or anything like that. That's what happened in that area for whatever reason. And we have lots of things like when we start to look at our life, we go, oh, here's things I can avoid, that so I don't get trampled, in a sense, emotionally trampled perhaps, or even physically trampled sometimes, I suppose. Avoiding being, I'm a big avoider of big crowds, for, but that's just, that's how I think of this. But I think the interesting thing here is, this is part of wise effort. This is like, oh wait, I know when I do this or think this or read this or consume this, I know where my mind ends up, which it isn't in a calm, still state. It's in a distracted state. And I end up not only having a distracted mind, I sometimes speak and act in pretty stupid ways because I've gone there. And so I avoid these things. This is what we can actually avoid. You know? And he mentions specifically, I think it's interesting, to avoid associating with bad friends. This is tough. This is a tough one because we all, you know, we have old friends, right? People we hung out with back in the day, right? And we see them and they go, oh, let's go do something that we used to all do together. And you know, if you go and do something with those folks again, you know exactly where it's going to go. And it's not that they're bad. It's just that they're caught in that culture of the way to have fun is to do these crazy things that we know lead us into suffering. So we don't do them anymore, which means I don't hang out with those people anymore. I choose not to. I avoid those sorts of activities and those sorts of gatherings. And that's just a matter of consciously being mindful, remembering, oh, I know what happens when I go there. I don't need to go there anymore. I don't need to go there mentally or emotionally or physically. I can avoid some things we just need to avoid. And this could be, you know, old friends. It could be that one relative that every time you go hang out with them and they rant about some their political views and you go, oh, and you get all caught up in some big, long political argument. Maybe you just avoid going there. Sometimes that's difficult. That's more difficult with relatives than with friends, but sometimes that's what we need to do. We go, okay, I don't need to hang out with that person anymore. I can avoid that person because I know where this is going to end up. And we keep thinking, oh no, I should go and try and make sure he really understands or she really understands. Like, I'm going to make them understand the truth, right? My view is more important than your view. Now we're caught up in the whole thing of my view is more than your view, blah, 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 blah. What a recipe for suffering. Guaranteed. Don't go there. Just avoid that as much as you can. Then he goes on. This is taints to be abandoned by removing. What taints bhikkhu should be abandoned by removing? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, does not tolerate an arisen thought of sensual desire. He abandons it, removes it, does away with it, and annihilates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of cruelty. He does not tolerate arisen evil, unwholesome. He abandons them, removes them, does away with them, and annihilates them. This is pretty strong language, right? But this is the second part of right effort. Sometimes we're just innocently going through, and then all of a sudden we notice how caught we are in some unwholesome state. You know, we're caught in, you know, that eternal argument with that person we shouldn't be hanging out with at all, but we hang there we were, and you know, it was Thanksgiving, and there we were, and there we, Uncle Charlie and I were ranting at each other yet again. You know, and this is like, oh, maybe just, there it is. I need to abandon this. When I see it there, I need to abandon. Abandon means give it up completely. The thing about this is this seems sort of contradictory, especially when we're talking about actual formal practice. You know, that, oh wait, I thought we're just pay attention to whatever's arising. And that's true. That's the initial instructions. It's quite, because we need to be able to accept the fact that these unwholesome thoughts and different things arise, and look at them and sit with them and be okay with them. Joseph Goldstein, I heard him say this once. It always struck me as how wonderful it was. He said, but after you've looked at it five times, looked at it really closely and honestly, you haven't avoided it, you haven't pushed it away, you've actually looked at it five times, then it's quite all right to go, nope, don't worry about this. I'm done telling myself this story yet again and looking really closely and feeling the emotions, because I know exactly where this goes. I've been there and I've been honest with myself and seen it for what it is. I don't need to go there anymore. I can just step back, go, nope, enough of this story. So this isn't like, oh, as soon as something unpleasant arises, it's okay to avoid. I'm not saying that or remove it. But sometimes you need to actually go, that's it, enough of this already. There is another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Vitakasatana Sutta, which is a list of five ways to actually remove things, which are progressively more vigorous. I'm not going to go into it today, but it's like, no, here's skillful things you can do. Things like just, oh, you just see something and you go, no, I'm not gonna go there. I'm gonna turn away from it. If it's something visual that's catching your eye, and you just turn away and don't look. But another classic thing, is that if you see an unwholesome thought arise, replace it with a wholesome thought. Just, no, I don't need that thought. I'll think this thought instead. I'm going to just, it's like changing gears, changing the recording on the, you know, the TV, or changing the channel on the TV. Don't need to watch that channel anymore. I've seen that movie too many times. I'm going to change the channel. One of the best ways to do this, especially if that what's going on, the story you're telling yourself, has to do with a particular person. We all have stories like that. That, you know, either you're the villain and you treated badly, or they're the villain and they treated you badly, or vice versa. Metta. Just change the story so the story is now thoughts of goodwill. Because often all that's going on is you're caught in thoughts of ill will towards these people or towards yourself because of what you did. Just change the to metta. Change the channel to the metta channel. You know, metta channel is available on all. Doesn't matter what system you subscribe to, the metta channel is always there, guaranteed for charge. Just tune into metta instead. And go, enough already. I don't need to do this anymore. I don't need to have these thoughts of ill will. I can have thoughts of goodwill instead. Very effective way to just remove an unwholesome thought. Finally, now we get to some good news. We remove the taints by developing. What taints bhikkhu should be abandoned by developing? Here a bhikkhu reflecting wisely develops the mindfulness enlightened factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. He develops the investigation of states enlightenment factor, the energy enlightenment factor, the rapture, and he goes through and lists all the seven factors of awakening. Oh, so now we're not like we're trying to get rid of anything. We're just like, let's just instead focus our energy on developing wholesome thoughts, wholesome mind states. Let's develop the seven factors of awakening. I mean, that's the beauty of the mind. And the one thing we keep forgetting is the mind can only have one thought at a time. And if I'm consciously filling my mind with wholesome thoughts and developing the seven factors of awakening, we're developing a wholesome mind state, then the unwholesome mind states just can't arise. Duh. But that's the way it works. It's like the more we cultivate wholesome mind states, the less likely it is that mind's going to go towards someone. It's a straight line equation. More of this gives you less of that, because there's only room for so much at one time, one thought at a time. That's how it works. Now, our minds are serial processors. We sometimes think we're thinking of three things at once, but actually we're just skipping really quickly from one thing to the next, many times perhaps in a loop. But we're not only ever thinking one thing at a time. So if I can have my mind full of wholesome thoughts, I can cultivate wholesome thoughts, but I can remove taint simply by developing the wholesome. And that's what this practice is all about. And some that's another thing this practice is all about is, oh wait, instead of trying to just, at this point, if we just look at what's all the taint, I'm stuck with this, I'm stuck with that, oh, I'm just, we get caught in that state. Instead, look, oh, here's these wholesome things that are also kind of rough. And it cures us. It makes us feel better to be have wholesome states arise. And this is just a matter of cultivating them. Of actually going, okay, I'm going to do something about this. Okay, so that's the seven ways to abandon the taints: seeing, restraining, using, enduring, avoiding, removing, and developing. My favorite one. But I do want to read, there's another section from Joseph's book I want to read. And he's talking about, it's what we'll call subtle impurities, subtle taints. And these are things when you think, we might not think of them even in this way, but it's interesting to reflect on what impurities means in terms of our practice. Some aspects of this word obvious, like wrong actions of body and speech, and unwholesome thoughts of greed, ill will, and cruelty. But the Buddha also spoke of subtle impurities, such as being lost in worldly thoughts of family and friends, of reputation, of work. As lay people living in the world, we do need to think about these things sometimes. But very often, we're simply lost in a kind of unnoticed reverie about them, drifting along in habits of thought that may not be particularly unwholesome, but may be inappropriate or unnecessary for the task at hand. Are they necessary? Probably not. The thought. Are they necessary? Probably not. We need to think about this. We need to think, oh, I'm gonna, what should I get my son for his birthday? We need to have those sort of thoughts, right? But we don't have to think about it for 3 weeks and mull over it and beat it. Just okay, it's just like we have to sort of understand that there's skillful limits to that kind of thought. It's necessary. We live in the world, we have relationships. These are good things to think about, but not to sort of just drift along in that world. Then Joseph comes on to even the deeper thing. And an even subtler level of impurity is when we're lost in Dharma thoughts about our practice and different meditative states. These thoughts are so seductive precisely because they are about the Dharma. And as with worldly thoughts, there are times when conscious, mindful Dharma reflection can be a big help on the path. But when we're simply lost in Dharma reveries or in judgments about our practice, they are not particularly helpful. How often do we get caught there, as good Buddhists that we all are, of course? Oh, my practice isn't going so well, or oh, Now my practice isn't as good as that other person, or blah, 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 blah. We get caught in that comparing mind, comparing ourselves to where we were yesterday, or comparing ourselves to somebody else, thinking about, was that, did I do that right? Or was I good? Was that a good meditation I had? Or bad meditation? He said, no, I just meditated. Whatever happened, that's what happened. As opposed to mulling it over and figured out and judging it. And so we don't need to go there. It's not helpful. They are not particularly helpful. I know, sort of a Joseph understatement there, but it's like a good one, I think. So then the final line of the sutta basically says, once we've abandoned all the taints, when we've really abandoned them all, wouldn't that be nice? And have penetrated conceit, which means this sense of a separate self, then we become enlightened. That's how the sutta ends, the last verse. This is how do we become enlightened? By working on these in these various skillful ways. Like it's listed seven skillful ways to work with things. That's what this sutta is about. Here's seven different skillful approaches you can take to working with stuff that's arising that gets in the way. But once we actually quote perfect that, then we could, and we've given up any sense of a separate self, then we'd actually be considered enlightened. But for us regular people, as we're moving towards that, we have to remember that's where we're headed, but we're not trying to sort of tie it down and make that be, oh, I'm not perfect, therefore why bother? It's like I'm moving towards something. That's all I'm ever trying to do. So, I like poetry. I actually have two poems tonight. I couldn't resist. The double poem whammy at the end here. The first one of these is one of these beautiful brief poems from Ryokan, the Zen poet, from it called One Robe, One Bowl. This is just a collection of his poetry. He was a 17th century Japanese Zen wandering monk. The rain has stopped. The clouds have drifted away. And the weather is clear again. If your heart is pure, then all things in your world are pure. Abandon this fleeting world. Abandon yourself. Then the moon and the flowers will guide you along the way. Oh, sweet. If your heart is pure, then all things in your world pure. Wow, there's the thought. And then something from the Falls here. It's from her book Going In. There's a poem called Metamorphs. Called beyond the confines of this chrysalis by a force I cannot see or name. I'm compelled by pain and something bigger than myself to leave the protection of all that I have known. There's a struggle, doubt, and awkward setting forth. Finally, I break free of the cocoon and find myself surrounded by air and light. I dare to act, still not knowing what I am. Instinct, or maybe faith, bids me move forward. Make the leap, explore this mystery of change and flight. I find myself with wings that dwarf my former world. Unfurled, they dry quickly in the sun. I, who expected to spend my days crawling, now teach myself to soar. Such a rush of wind and freedom. That first flight teaches me more than I had learned in a lifetime of crawling. That's a pretty good description of a moment of enlightenment. And I love that the image is just wonderful. It was like that You're cocooned. We're cocooned by our thoughts of who we are and how things should be. But if I dare to act, still not knowing what I am, instinct or maybe faith bids me move forward, make the leap, explore this mystery of change and flight. I find myself with wings that dwarf my former world.